Kia ora and welcome back to System Fix, a podcast from the health media. My name is Barbara Fountain and I am editor of New Zealand Doctor Rata Aotearoa. Each episode of System Fix, we take a look at progress with the reforms proposed for the New Zealand health system. These arose from the report of the Health and Disability System Review Panel, aka the Simpson Report. However, they have been significantly revved up by Health Minister Andrew Little to become what I like to call the Big Little Revolution. On System Fix, I speak with regular panellists and invited guests about the changes, the highs, the lows, what's happened to date, and what we might expect. Thanks for joining me. Kia ora, and welcome to episode 19 of System Fix. Let's call it Almost There, because dismantling the health system culture and replacing it with a new, collaborative, inclusive, equity-focused vibe might be just a little like destroying the Death Star. You get the job done, only to find they've been busy building another one on the sly. It's been a little while in the making, this episode, recorded just before Queen's birthday, so I'll keep the recap short. A few key events since last episode include the recommendations of the Paiora Legislation Committee, the tabling of the budget, and the announcement of appointments to senior roles at Health New Zealand. Regular System Fix panellists, independent health policy consultant Gabrielle Baker, and Auckland University health policy researcher Tim Tenbensel, and I find plenty more to talk about in this whistle-stop tour of developments. Kia ora, guys.
Kia ora.
Kia ora.
How have you been?
I've been freezing in Wellington. That's how I've been.
We're experiencing global warming in Auckland, or we have been. 20 degrees in June.
That's wild.
Yes, and it's not just wild on the weather. It's wild out there in health reform land, isn't it?
It is. It's all happening.
It's been a month since we got together. So I think the Paiora Legislation Committee came back with its recommendations. I don't think we've actually talked much about that. And we've also had the first steps of primary care transformation program being put out. We had the budget recently, which has obviously put the money on the table.
Yeah.
And we've had the appointments to the senior roles and by Health NZ. A lot to talk about. It seems like quite a while ago, but with regards to the Paiora bill, we did have Health Minister Andrew Little kind of doing a bit of a turnaround and introducing an amendment to allow for a rural health strategy. But it seems to be there was some pressure from within the party.
Yeah, and there was certainly pressure from the Rural Health Network.
One of the things that's been coming through to us recently is the minister often comments on the corner dairy model of general practice, and recently also made similar comments about rural practices kind of being not prepared to change their ways. So I think the rural sector has felt a little bit let down overall by the reforms to date. So this will probably be a big boon for them, and also Gabrielle for rural Māori as well, because that covers a lot.
Health inequities that are rural are particularly Māori rural health inequities. So from that perspective, it's great to see a focus on rural health. I was kind of surprised on one level because it hadn't been picked up in the committee stage, and because there seems to be a little bit of a pushback or maybe guarding exactly what gets into legislation around what is a strategy and what is not. The PharmAct report was just released, and so there was discussions about whether there's a medicine strategy or a rare condition strategy. Well, the introduction of the rural health strategy into the legislation makes me think it's a bit less clear now what becomes a strategy that's legislated for and what isn't.
Yeah.
The other thing I'd say is that I thought the line that the minister was taking before was that this would come under the localities, and that's where rural health access and primary care would be handled. So from that point of view, it looks like a bit of a back down.
I seem to recall that in the Legislation Committee report, they did make a point like that around their reasoning for not including a rural health strategy.
You've asked me, Barbara, to think about what are some of the good things that have happened. And I guess I was pleasantly surprised to see a more explicit role for the Iwi Māori Partnership Boards in the Paiora legislation following the Select Committee. And also, I guess, more of a role for those boards, the Iwi Māori Partnership Boards, I guess, having some decision-making power in the way the system is set up through the legislation. So specifically, that's about their ability to agree to things like locality plans.
That was one of the surprises, wasn't it, that when the bill came back, they had actually removed all the current iwi partnership boards and made a clean slate. Makes a lot of sense.
Well, it did make a lot of sense because it was never going to match the localities. And now I think it probably may have been an outcome of the early work on localities. And you can see with the nine localities that were were chosen, they all did have strong relationships to local iwi. Gabriel may be in a better position to comment on the nuances of that, but you know, it seemed to, you know, that's the scale they were going to go for. They couldn't keep the wording that was in the original legislation.
And that actually brings to mind the other thing that's been announced since we talked last was, in fact, the locality prototypes. Time is flying. So we've got 9 prototype localities around the country. To date, one of them has announced their Iwi Māori Partnership Board, so they're working on those relationships. Any thoughts on progress there?
Well, I kind of wish I had thoughts, but my main thing is whenever I've tried to figure out what they're expected to be doing right this minute, I get very confused. So when I read it one way, I think, oh, by the 1st of July, we kind of have a set of knowing what they're going to be doing. But in another, when I read it another way, by the 1st of July, at most, we might have some relationships in place. So I don't have much to say except that I'm a little confused about what they're focusing on and when they're going to start.
In the budget, we saw money for development of comprehensive primary care teams. That had us thinking a little bit about that money isn't that the kind of thing that the prototypes will be working on developing. But then I suppose the locality is working on developing a prototype for how organisations work together, and maybe the money for comprehensive primary care teams is looking at developing workforces that work together better.
I was going to say, when you asked us to prep and said what are the good signs, what are the bad signs, I think certainly in my good signs list is, I think, the process by which those 9 localities were selected. And the word that I've heard was that was a very genuine process in which there was quite a lot of community and iwi energy in, you know, just sort of getting on board with the idea of localities from local communities. The government is sort of saying, look, we are going to prioritise areas where there's a high level of Māori health need.
Another thing that's come up since we last talked was Health New Zealand put out the expressions of interest for the primary care transformation program, First Steps. And that had a long list of what is essentially a kind of a wish list for a primary care, things like reviewing the capitation funding formula, setting up new national health pathways, and if I could remember the rest of them, I would say. But the problem there was that they were looking for people who could be seconded from current roles, which kind of excludes NGOs and Māori and Health Pacifica providers and general practice of primary care, because many of these people can't actually be seconded away without backfill, is the word they used, which I hadn't come across before. So it sounded like a great list of things to get underway, but maybe some of the people with the most knowledge in those areas wouldn't be able to be party to that process, those projects.
That's such a good point. And one of the things that I was thinking about in the good column is that there are lots of people, when I talk to them, I find out that they're doing work for Health New Zealand and they're incredible people, and or the Māori Health Authority. So there's incredible people, I think. Thank goodness they've got your skills. But they already had full-time jobs that I was grateful they were doing. So it's a kind of a double-edged sword, isn't it?
Generally, I think that point about who's getting snapped up, and yes, you do hear, you know, sort of good people getting snapped up in these transformation processes at a time where you just want to clone them.
And talking about snapped up, so we saw Ashley Bloomfield's temporary replacement has been announced, Diana Safarati, who's been running the Cancer Control Agency. Interesting move.
What looks interesting is it's a continuation of someone with a public health background in the Director General role. Maybe a smart move. You know, I think that's a signal in itself. Have no idea what the process was, sort of the usual public sector process.
It was interesting reading through the budget documents, kind of spelt out very clearly all the roles that are leaving the Ministry of Health. And it has got a sum of money over $200 million for its role as chief steward of the health system. It will be interesting to see how that works out. And one of the things that you've probably noticed as well is in the last few weeks, we've seen the movement away from the transition unit being involved with a lot of the work to Health NZ, not so much that we're hearing from the Māori Health Authority as yet, and that's showing pretty quickly where the centre of power is going to be.
The flip side of what you were just talking about, the sort of you know, people getting seconded into transformation sort of roles, is what happens to those people within the Ministry of Health in particular, but also sometimes in DHBs, that are, you know, not necessarily fully on board with the agenda and where the government wants to go. Particularly, I'm thinking this in terms of the different approach to public sector management, or, you know, public policy, which is, you know, kind of meant to be more collaborative, more, you know, promoting co-design, trust-based sort of models, and yet you still have a generation of senior public servants that were schooled in the importance of hands-off, transactional sort of relationships, don't trust anybody who spends public money on our behalf. You know, and that mentality is still alive and well. And I would expect that view of the world will probably end up in senior ranks in Health New Zealand.
Now we're getting closer to the 1st of July. The political lens is being placed on the health reforms, in particular the role of the Māori Health Authority. And there's been a discussion tied in with the Three Waters around the co-governance issue. Do you think, Gabrielle, that the way the Māori Health Authority has been presented, that it's been well explained in terms of its role? Because it is not a co-governance role.
It's certainly not a co-governance role. So last night I was true to myself and I watched Parliament debating High Water Bill at like 8:30. And a lot of the discussion then was about, you know, how this is co-governance and how it's, you know, the thin edge of the wedge kind of argument, because it's giving so much power and control to Māori. And, you know, these are by people who do know what the bill actually says. It's much more kind of willfully misleading, I found, then there needed to be better explanations. Like, it's clear this is still an agency that the minister gets to make the final calls on. This is still an agency that has to abide by almost exactly the same rules that every other government agency has to abide by. There's a slightly different relationship it has with its board potentially, you know, but this is a very long way away from what it's being touted as from those who want to detract from it and say that it's co-governance and the end of what of health as we know it.
It's interesting to contrast the National and ACTS line of attack, and it seems that the co-governance or ACTS one has anything gained more traction than National's one of separatism, which is, I think, is very, very interesting. But still, that's what oppositions do. I think the government's getting more heat on Three Waters than it is on the health reforms. I think the reason, and there is an important difference, is that in Three Waters, it's, you know, sort of the policy community, the those sort of part of the regular discussions, the local government and organisations representing them, you know, they are critiquing it, whereas we're not getting health sector organisations critiquing. They might be, you know, contesting some of the details of a whole lot of things, but not strongly critiquing the direction of the reform or the rationale for them. When that happens, then oppositions don't get quite as much oxygen that they can board a public campaign on. That might change when it comes to implementation, but if you ask what surprises me, it's that it hasn't had more political heat so far.
I kind of wonder if that's mostly due to the fact that we've been distracted by the pandemic, and also because it is actually quite a nuanced new relationship, the Māori Health Authority versus Health NZ versus the Ministry of Health and the iwi Māori Partnership Boards. Maybe it's just taken the other politicians a while to catch up with System Fix now, if they've been listening to us from the start.
Well, you think that National would have to be pretty careful if they wanted to sort of wind it back, and then there would be, I think, some significant resistance to that from within the sector.
I did write an editorial a little while ago about Chris Luxon's comments we would get rid of the Māori Health Authority, and I just really feel it's so out of touch with the developments that have taken place in the sector. We can't just innovate and tweak a little bit more. We actually do need dramatic change.
I think we may have talked about this before, but when I looked at the High Order Bill submissions, almost every health organisation that submitted was in support of the Māori Health Authority. The numbers-wise, there are lots of individuals who submitted against it, and there are a very small number of those were also claiming health credentials. You know, they might be a doctor, or by and large, the parts of the health system that need to make this work were saying they were supportive of a Māori Health Authority.
That says it all, really. I mean, they've been working in the system. They understand that it's been going wrong. So just going back to the budget, which came out on the 19th of May, Grant Robertson touted it as a big, big budget for health, and a lot of that was related to the investment they're putting into their new organisations. To be honest, it's actually really difficult to put an exact figure on what the increase is for health, because this year some of the money from Vote Health, the COVID money has gone, and some of the money for disability services has also gone into Vote Social Development. What was announced was $1.8 billion in new funding for Healthy NZ for the next 2 years, actually, and then next year an additional $1.3 billion. Then for the Māori Health Authority, it was $168 million over 4 years, $20 million for the development of iwi Māori partnership boards, and the Ministry of Health was going to get $266 million to undertake its stewardship role. So that's on top of the other operational funding it will still be getting, I believe. Again, with regard to the Māori Health Authority, there's been criticism that that sum is minuscule compared to the money going into Healthy NZ. The counter argument to that is that Healthy NZ is still going to be providing services for Māori. That most of Healthy NZ's budget is coming out of the budgets that were once with the DHBs and then a sum of money from the Ministry of Health. How do you guys feel about that criticism in terms of the message that the budget for Māori Health Authority, in fact that's over 4 years, is sending to the sector? Is it just early days?
I am kind of concerned. Of course, the Māori Health Authority needs to be funded for its role. We shouldn't just go how it should have the same as Health New Zealand. I'm not suggesting that. I was more interested in how much the Ministry of Health was getting to do its stewardship role as the comparator, because Māori Health Authority has to do a whole lot of those stewardship things within its role, holding the health system to account, supporting co-commissioning by Health New Zealand and those kind of things. So it was a more comparable role to me, and they seem to be getting significantly less than Ministry of Health. So to me, this looks a little bit fishy.
Your thoughts, Tim?
Yeah, similar. I think it's hard to know what the right amount is, you know, because we sort of the symbolism does also look a little bit odd. But I'd be interested to know what the discussions have been. I won't know, but we won't know, but what the discussions have been from within the Māori Health Authority as to what sort of level they would have been requesting or putting in a bid for. That may well come out in time.
How many DHB chief executives does it take to create a new health system? The list of jobs was dominated by current DHB chief executives, and I suppose it's not surprising. We have to give them something to do while the new system beds in.
It's an interesting mix. So some are kind of still in their patch, you know, like Nick Chamberlain still in Northland, for example, and others are sort of moving to quite sort of interesting system roles like Dale Bramley or Kerianna Brookie. You know, those are the roles that I think are going to be the ones that end up being absolutely crucial to how the new structure beds down. It's going to take a while to shake down, I think. And I guess the risk is that the structure might end up getting a bit top-heavy in transition, whereas if you designed it from scratch, it wouldn't look like that.
For me, the mapping across of so many DHB CEs, like it has a really practical, you know, there's a practical rationale behind it. But this group of the top tier, in a way, of the health system are hardly representative of Aotearoa. So I think you've mentioned the full extent of the Māori in those positions. There are disabled people featuring in senior positions. So by just mapping across that part, I know it's temporary, but I want it to be very temporary. I want us to have a senior workforce that reflects the populations we're trying to serve.
An interesting appointment, I thought, was Andrew Slater, the chief executive of Whakarongora Aotearoa, to lead the transformation agenda, because certainly in his role at Whakarongora, you know, they've done a huge amount of work in the last 2 years with their response to the COVID pandemic. Interesting choice.
Yeah, I think a good one. He's quite visionary and got a track record of making things happen and bringing people along with him. You know, I think going back to setting up sort of the new sort of health line structure, and that worked out much more smoothly than I had expected, and, you know, is a good service in many ways. So, yeah, our 1737 and all those sorts of things are embedded into that. So he clearly has a track record in making things happen.
Another thing that's been in the news recently has been the cost of the consultants involved with EY. And obviously consultants always come with a cost. But the question is, has it been a good move for the reform of this health system to be driven by outside consultants who will ultimately leave the arena?
You would like a one-word answer, I would say no. I'm in a glass house because I'm a consultant. That is how the work I do. But, I mean, some of those amounts are kind of eye-watering, and I know that there'll be a lot of people represented in that amount. So I'm not suggesting any individual is getting paid an eye-watering amount, but it's a lot of money that isn't going to supporting an ongoing workforce. The other thing I was thinking, I had another thought about this. Oh, this is a perception thing, but when I was watching the budget speech from the minister the morning after, it felt like an EY event. So I was watching it on the streaming. It was EY logo, consultants as speakers from the beginning. To me, it's a perception thing that I didn't expect to see.
Yeah, I agree with that. And Barbara, you and I were both there in the room. I had a similar reaction. I thought the optics of this are not ideal. And in terms of where the money's going, well, it's paying for a nice view.
I had the same thought. I thought, this is a lovely office.
I mean, your earlier question, Barbara, about whether having an external agency, you know, private organisation come in and do the work of the design. And in one sense, it's justifiable in that you wouldn't want the Ministry of Health trying to do this, and Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet didn't, you know, wouldn't have capacity on its own to do it. So something would have had to happen there. The vulnerability, of course, is you, the people that set up the vision, and they're not around to implement it. So they've got long gone by the time that actually really play out. And I think we've seen, you know, 20 years ago, that even though it wasn't done the same way, you had the same issue of the people who came up with the vision and the ideas moving on quite quickly afterwards, and the people that came in behind them not having that institutional memory, not having the same commitment to the kaupapa, not having the same, you know, sort of drive to, you know, make things happen when obstacles appear.
Just in the last month, is there anything in particular that surprised you coming out of the health reforms? Tell us what you're worried about, Tim.
Well, I'm worried about the, you referred to it earlier, you know, sort of when you talked about how the rural health sector reacted to the minister's comments about the GPs being part of the area, or, you know, sort of old-fashioned business model. And that's yet another iteration, I think, of what we've seen a lot over the last 5 to 10 years, that there's quite a lot of disgruntlement in what we might call traditional primary care. There's quite a lot of talk about the sustainability of general practice, which is interesting. And the positions on this are very, very far apart in the sector in primary care. This is, I think, not a very welcoming environment for the localities to start and flourish. That'll matter more in some places than others. And particularly of the whole funding conversation about how primary care is funded, and there's people that want quite different things in that space, you know, once some detail has landed on that, then that's where the political risk is going to be in the implementation of the reforms, at least on the primary care side.
Well, we saw the PSAC meeting, PHO Services Amendment Protocol meeting, in which general practice was offered a 3% increase on capitation, or PHOs, which in a time of high inflation, I mean, obviously they're incredibly upset about it. The health reforms started with David Clark promising a review of the primary care funding, and here we are, and the funding issue has still not been addressed. And I think a lot of them see it being parked until localities kind of take effect in 2024. And this isn't just about general practice. Our Māori and Pacifica providers work in capitated environments as well. Yeah. The quote I enjoyed the most was that the only traditional thing about general practice these days is the funding formula. Something along those lines from the president of the college. And also what was interesting, for the first time, we saw Health NZ on the letterhead of the media release coming out. So, you know, they're right in there in those conversations now. So they're coming out with their justifications for a 3% increase on capitation.
Do you get a sense that that's just another sort of holding pattern? Yes, we're getting to it, but, you know, for the moment, we'll just go another year.
If that's what they think, I think they're really out of touch with how a general practice is actually struggling. I mean, we're looking at the pay parity issue, you know, general practice, all the NGOs employing nurses can't keep up with DHB sector. And aged care is even another huge area. So if they think they can park it, they're parking it at a time when GPs who might have stayed on for another couple of years are kind of thinking, nah, not fighting this battle anymore, not sitting in front of my practice nurse another day and saying, sorry, we can't afford to increase your wages.
Yeah, true. And there's another side to this, which is if there are reasons for government to talk to primary medical care, that's the GP sector, who do they talk to? The interest group environment in primary care is an absolute schmozzle. It's, you know, we just had the demise of the NZMA in the middle of all that. And it's sort of like sometimes you need at least for some sort of process to be there. And, you know, there are all sorts of power issues and imbalances of power. But from a government point of view, you want to, you know, at least have a conversation with one voice representing primary care.
I mean, the GPLF, the General Practice Leaders Forum, it tries to act as a single group. But on that point, I've talked about the NZMA demise. The Federation, someone said to me, is the Federation still operating? Federation of Primary Care? And I thought, that's a very good question. Yeah. I'm pretty sure they appointed someone just recently.
Yeah, we don't hear from them.
Yeah, Anna King had high hopes for that group as a means of bringing all those voices together. I understand what you're saying about the multitude of voices and also the concern that other primary care providers aren't involved in this, but the PHO contract is that, and the way the PHOs were set up and the way they were funded excluded effectively from day one a lot of other primary care providers. And whenever I hear Andrew Little complain about the traditional business practices, I'm thinking just about every primary care provider, whether it's a dentist or a physio or a midwife or a pharmacist, exists on a private business model because that is how the government has left it.
It's bigger than
It is. Sorry, it is bigger than that.
It's bigger than that. It's international. That's how they're organised in every high-income country.
So, but you can't just keep wishing that away. Andrew Little, with some of his comments recently, he's been quite, I kind of called it grumpy about the general practice, particularly because he identifies that business model in general practice and I think forgets that all these other practitioners have to use a similar business model. And he's been the health minister for 2 years. And these guys have been working in general practice for 30 or 40 years waiting for these changes. And sure, there are some out there who are stick in the mud and would just be happy to see the end of their days and close the door. But there are a lot who are just as concerned about the lack of outcomes for their patients.
True, but there's also a lot of people in senior roles and positions across the sector that are saying the same thing that Andrew Little was saying. A lot.
I think that it's easier to merge 20 DHBs into one LTNZ than it is to find an answer to primary care funding.
That sums it up.
Oh dear.
I might actually say something that's almost at odds with what you just said. One of the things I'm surprised by is just how much chaos there is still happening in transitioning 20 DHBs to a single Health New Zealand. And I have to say that some of my thinking on that is in light of just how much has been spent on consultants to support the transition. But not that long ago, when I was talking to some people, I got no sense of people knowing where they were mapping to from the 1st of July, no sense of knowing which HR policies were going to apply from day one. Or, you know, like I felt like what I really felt was everyone's just hoping for the best on the 1st of July, when I would have thought, given they've been working on this for so long, the transition, you know, would have had a sense of what functions need to go where, those kinds of things, those kind of day one ready things, so that Health New Zealand can start on day one with those and then get on to the content. But I'm not seeing it, and I was kind of surprised that it seemed so very chaotic.
Yeah, and it does seem like there's this fresh new organisational design in Health New Zealand, but then there's going to be whole bits of the ministry that are going to be dropped somewhere into that. But, you know, it's going to be a strange mixture of old and new.
Quite a wide-ranging discussion today.
I've got lots of thoughts on non-performativity, but I won't go.
That's interesting. What was that?
So what I was thinking about with non-performativity is that
performativity.
The idea, which I'm extracting from Sarah Ahmed, who writes on this stuff, but for me it's the idea that you say that equity is important, you say that titidity is important, but it's almost like just the act of saying that is all you're prepared to do to make that true. And so if anyone ever criticises you, you say, but I said equity was important, but I said titidity was, or waitangi was important. And I was thinking about it very specifically because in the speeches in the committee stage of the legislation, the minister was talking about how, you know, they're embedding the principles of titidity or waitangi in there. They're honouring what was set out in Y2575, the Waitangi Tribunal's report into primary healthcare. And that sounds great. But then when I look at some of the documents coming, floating around, you know, in the ether, I see that's kind of been downgraded. So it gets downgraded to, we're going to follow the principles set out in Whakamoa. And Whakamoa is the action plan that sits under He Kōrua Wai Oranga. So what they've done is they've taken these high-level principles that already many would argue are a reduction in the impact of titidity or waitangi, but at least interrogated by our courts, And they've turned it into, actually, we're only going to meet the standard set out in an action plan, which, of course, can be changed at any point in any time. So,
yes,
I'm getting into the detail of the stuff I love. So it's quite hard to convey maybe in a podcast, but that's, I'm seeing that across multiple areas. But when I saw that on Tutility, I just thought, ugh. So what they're doing is they're taking the things that are right, diluting it, and then saying job done.
That's, I mean, this is how government works generally with lots and lots of other sorts of principles, or, you know, this is how it evolves. It just does. You make the commitment first and then you think, what the hell do we do?
Yeah, and I think, I mean, I'm sure that is happening. And it's not that I wouldn't have tolerance of trying to figure it out, but it's just from day one seeing things be diluted is kind of like the alarm bell is going off already.
The subtlety, because I also wonder to what extent having the Y2575 report there as this kind of a document that you can refer back to in terms of actually just remind ourselves, this is, you know, the findings, and if that wasn't there, it would be even more difficult, I think, to keep an eye on the slippage that you're talking about.
I think that report is really valuable in trying to keep track of some of these things that over the 20-year period of DHBs were just letting things were sliding. Every year something more would slide and you get further and further away from the vision.
Thank you for another wonderful chat. And we should try and get together before the 1st of July. Maybe chaos.
We could have a wake. Stay awake with our wake.
Ngā mihi. Thank you.
Kia ora.
Kia ora.
Since we recorded this episode, the Director General of Health, Ashley Bloomfield, has announced a new executive structure for the Ministry of Health. The Paiora Healthy Futures Bill has passed its third reading, both ACT and National opposing its passage. Health Ministers Andrew Little and Pena Hanare announced the members of the Interim Hauora Māori Advisory Committee. This committee will advise the Minister of Health on matters relating to the Māori Health Authority Board and with regard to the Public Health Advisory Committee. 8 members have been appointed to the interim committee. 6 of these members were appointed to the 2021 steering group led by Tā Mason-Jury to provide advice on governance arrangements and initial appointments to the interim Māori Health Authority. Elsewhere in the sector, recruitment agencies Kerrigan Partners and Mana Recruitment are helping with executive appointments at both the Māori Health Authority and Health New Zealand. And now the 1st of July date that has been on the horizon for so long is nearly upon us. Keep your ears open. System Fix will be back. Thanks for listening to System Fix, brought to you by the Health Media. If you would like to learn more about the health reforms and other issues in primary care, you can subscribe to New Zealand Doctor, Rāte Aotearoa, on nzdoctor.co.nz. Or to keep up with issues in the pharmacy sector, go to pharmacytoday.co.nz. Both publications now offer monthly subscriptions. Thank you to Steve Hart for post-production work on System Fix. This is Barbara signing off. Until next time. Thanks for listening. Ngā mihi nui.